Righto. What's the one thing you want for your teenager? You want them to be happy. Of course you do. You want to protect them from life's crap. Well, you can't. Crap's going to happen and will keep on happening because that's life. And I'm supposed to be the positive one. What you can do is help them prepare for it. And the best way to prepare them is to piss off into the bush together. Resilience for Families by Resilience Builders takes you and your child to Cradle Mountain in the stunning wilderness of Tasmania. Over 4 days, you'll learn proven techniques to cope with life's crap and live a happier life. You'll do things you never thought possible and you'll do them together, building your resilience and your bond. The next Resilience for Families Cradle Mountain program runs in September. Search Resilience Builders or call them on 1300 001 606. Thanks, Resilience Builders. G'day, Groovers. Welcome to another installment of The U Project. Craig Anthony Harper. Melissa Marie Cameron, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Look, I'm a little bit nervous because we've got a brainiac on and I don't know if I'll be able to keep up because I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed, as everybody at Brain Park will attest, but I'll do my very best. Now, I'm going to read a little bit about Paul before we get underway. Paul Litnitsky, that's exactly right, is head of the psychedelic research group at Monash, where I reside. He's in the smart end. I'm in my orange cubicle all by myself. He's the chief principal investigator and research fellow at Monash and has adjunct or honorary appointments at St. Vincent's Hospital, Macquarie University, Deakin University, University of Melbourne. So not much at all, mate. You've been pretty lazy, really, haven't you?
Yes, I've been lying around, I should say, yes, just relaxing here.
Thanks for getting out of the jacuzzi and off the hammock to come and have a chat to us.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on, Craig, and hi, Melissa.
Yeah, thanks, mate. We really appreciate it. A couple of weeks ago, we have these, they're not compulsory, they're kind of encouraged meetings at Monash at midday on Mondays, And you know, let's just say that some of them are riveting, some aren't, but that's okay. They're all okay. And Paul got—I didn't even know Paul existed, but Paul's newish to Monash. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes, I'm very new at Monash. Yep.
And Paul got introduced to the group, and then when I heard what he does and what he's about, I sat up like a little fucking meerkat to attention, Melissa, an academic meerkat, because I went, oh, giddy up, this will be awesome. And it was. And Paul kind of gave us a 40-45 minute snapshot of what he's about and what he's doing and why this research matters. And so, mate, it's an honor to have you on, and we're really interested. We have not had really one conversation in 430 episodes, or not a significant conversation about psychedelics, and especially not the potential application for, you know, psychedelics to be used in therapeutic and clinical situations. So give us a little, firstly, so there'll be some people listening right now going, what's a psychedelic? Mm-hmm. I know that's the most fundamental of questions, but can we start there?
Yeah, sure. So a psychedelic is a class of drugs that produces perhaps the most dramatic and unusual changes to conscious awareness of any kind of class of drugs that we can consume. So the most common psychedelics are, or the most widely known psychedelics are LSD and psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, and DMT, and which you find in a plant brew called ayahuasca. Many people would have heard of that. But then the term is actually becoming looser by the month and now encompasses often a broader set of substances like MDMA, what you'd hope to find in ecstasy in the street, which you generally don't, and even substances like ketamine and iboga, that often loosely referred to as psychedelics, although the classical psychedelics are a tighter group of substances. And so, you know, we are combining these drugs with a form of psychotherapy in the treatment of mental illnesses. So it's important to just say that from the outset, that when we're talking about, when I'm talking about psychedelics, I'm generally not just talking about drugs and what they do. I'm talking about drugs in combination with a whole treatment program, if you like. And the way I think about it, and the way a lot of people in the field think about it, is flipped the other way around. It's a form of augmented psychotherapy. that we're investigating.
It's kind of, has research into psychedelics been something that's kind of, I feel like it's stopped and started a bit over the years. Like, wasn't yep. there a fair bit of research in the 50s and the 60s, or was it the 40s and it kind of got canned?
Yes, that's right. So, you know, in very broad terms, psychedelics entered psychiatry in the late 40s, really made a, you know, made a mark through the 50s and 60s. There were about 15 very productive years there where, you know, at least in the States, it looked like psychedelics were taking psychiatry by storm. It was certainly the next big thing. There were, you know, there were 40,000 patients prescribed with LSD. So that's a lot of LSD in a clinical context. And, you know, and there were international conferences on the topic and, you know, over 1,000 academic journal articles. It was highly productive. There were all kinds of applications and a whole set of different classes of drugs. The most common one in that first wave of psychedelic psychiatry that was used was LSD. But MDMA was also used in a number of different contexts. So, you know, commonly in that wave, MDMA was used in couples counseling, and LSD was used in alcohol dependence treatment, but also for depression and for other indications. And then basically the field came to a grinding halt through complex processes. But, you know, the simplest story or take home around that end to the first wave of psychedelic psychiatry is a political story. It was really considered a public enemy number one, and Tim Leary was the face of that. And I think probably for some good reasons, the Nixon government felt threatened by LSD. That, you know, LSD does seem to increase countercultural or, you know, anti-establishment views. There were probably a whole set of other cultural factors that, that were at play as well. I don't think the entire zeitgeist of the hippie movement was you know, fueled only by LSD, but it contributed probably.
Yeah.
And yeah. And so Nixon, you know, he had an issue with the anti-establishment and the hippie movement, primarily because they were opposed to his dirty war in Nam, and he also had an issue with black people in America. For other reasons. And so, you know, there was this kind of war on drugs, which was basically designed to target African-American people and the, you know, anti-war left via massive prohibition and the ways in which they could associate those groups with drugs and then, you know, put them in prison or break up the groups and vilify them in various ways. And so that was actually admitted to. There's a great quote from John Ehrlichman, who was one of the architects of the war on drugs. The war on drugs was kind of ratified in 1971. And that was passed on through multiple international treaties to most of the world. So Australia very much signed on to the war on drugs. And John Ehrlichman, who was in Nixon's government and involved in devising this whole plan, admitted in a series of interviews in the late 90s that, you know, the quote that comes out of his mouth was, you know, did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. It was all very political. So the field came to a grinding halt. The funding was sucked out of it, and it, you know, took on stigma and a whole set of prejudices. And it's really been, it's been in the deep freeze for decades. And you know, there's been a slow reintroduction. A few brave souls began work in the space in the late 90s. There was a little island of work in the early 90s, and then it really kicked off in the late 90s, and has, you know, slowly escalated, and now, you know, is escalating at a rapid rate. There's a massive and burgeoning field of psychedelic medicine all over the world now. And in the last 12 months, you know, commercial interest has also increased dramatically in this space.
So it's been, do you think it's been over the decades unjustly vilified for, you know, the wrong reasons, and now people are maybe starting to wake up that that was kind of bullshit?
Yes, I mean, I think in large part that's true. It's not to say that this stuff is likely to work for everybody, nor do I think it's, you know, incredibly safe regardless of how we do it.
Yes.
But certainly the kind of the common prejudices that came out of the 60s and 70s around it are unjustified. You know, the scheduling of these drugs in the States wasn't rationalized in scientific and or medical terms as it should be. The American scheduling system of drugs is predicated on abuse potential and medical value. Mm. And these drugs were put into Schedule One, which is the class reserved for drugs that have no known medical value and a high abuse potential. And for the classical psychedelics like LSD, there was 15 years of good evidence indicating to the contrary on both those fronts. Mm. So it was really predicated on a mistruth. So I think, yes, they have been unfairly maligned. And I think there is a massive shift in public perception around these drugs and their applications, whether in the therapeutic context or the personal development context or the recreational context. I will say, as you know, as a further point, though, you know, I've been a scholar of the field for about a decade, and so I've mapped in my conversations and contact with, you know, the scientific and medical and public communities, a shift in perspective that has clearly moved in the last few years from one that I'd characterize as old world conservatism to new world evangelism. Mm. And so we have another set of socio-political issues around new world evangelism that I think underestimates the complexity of this treatment approach and some of the inherent risks. Mm. And inflates expectations. Mm. And perhaps is more of an issue now than the old world conservatism, which is falling away rapidly. Partly because we have this massive hype, inflated expectancy in the community of people suffering with mental illness, which is not, I think putting out a view that this is a cure-all, that it is for everybody, that it's a one and done, that it's simple, that it's in the bag, that we know how to do this really well, is just not true. And also, if that view is taken on by advocates or scientists or clinicians in the space, then I think a lot of the work that needs to be done to get this treatment well developed and further developed is just not going to be done. I think people are going to underestimate the work that's still in front of us.
Yeah. And obviously we can't have people coming in who have an agenda to produce certain outcomes because they have certain, preconceived hopes going in to the research. So why are you excited about this stuff? I know why I'm excited about neuropsych. I know why I'm doing my stuff. What floats your boat with this?
Yeah, there are a number of exciting pieces of psychedelic medicine for me. You know, the obvious one at the center of it all is it seems to work. And it seems to work not necessarily for everybody, though we don't know exactly who it will work for and who it won't work for, because it, whatever it is still being developed and nuanced. You know, there isn't just this obvious out of the box thing called psychedelic assisted therapy that we are clear on. It can change and develop and morph, and so that may affect who it's going to be useful for. But it's, you know, it's the early data so far from many groups around the world indicates that this is well more effective for a subset of people suffering with mental illnesses than anything else that is available. And so that's exciting. We're seeing effect sizes that are three or fourfold the next best clinical effect size.
Wow.
for severe cases of various kinds of mental health issues like depression or PTSD. In some cases, the you know, it's as good or slightly better than next best treatment. In some cases, it's massively better. I suspect some of the, you know, some of the effect size will reduce over time because early treatments are often more impressive than they turn out to be. And so I think, and there's some good reasons for that. I mean, the placebo component on a new treatment is usually larger than it is later down the track, as it was for, you know, early antidepressants like Prozac. Prozac worked better in the late 80s than it does now.
That's so fascinating.
Yeah.
Just that, whole bloody thing about, you know, expectation and like, but there is a physiological response to the psychological, isn't there? Like it's when you believe, anyway, that's a different conversation, but that does fascinate me.
It's well, it's a good segue to the second point I was going to make about why this floats my boat. You know, some people wonder whether high dose psychedelics, which is what we're using, it's good to kind of differentiate that because I have a lot of conversations where, you know, somewhere down the way in the conversation, the person I'm speaking with realizes I'm not talking about microdosing.
Yes.
And
yes.
I'm not. These are, you know, these are high doses that we deliver in a clinical context that occasion, you know, dramatic altered states of consciousness that are rated by most participants as being among the most challenging and personally profound or meaningful experiences of their lives. So this is whopping stuff. But a lot of people, particularly people on the outside of the field, will ask questions like, you know, is it all placebo? And that you know, for anybody who is on the inside of this field, who knows, you know, enough about the patient experiences, and knows the data and the whole, you know, treatment protocol and what actually goes down, or who has subjective experience with, you know, clinically supported psychedelics, that would be an absurd question. You know, and so this is part of why I'm interested in this, is because the psychedelic encounter, which has, you know, many, you know, a diverse array of manifestations across different people, is like a, you know, a waterfall of psychological content and shifts in perspective and nuanced feelings and experiences that are just remarkable in terms of their breadth and the way they can compel change in a person's life and the apparent wisdom or reliability of the representations that are manifest, you know, under psychedelics. People have, it's a very common experience that people will say that while the walls are melting and bending and there's a whole set of, you know, drug-induced distortions, and they're well aware they're under the influence of a drug and it's a distortion, there are some elements of the psychedelic experience, typically the stuff that really matters for us in a clinical context, that feels like a more reliable representation of reality than their sober state. It's like waking up out of the dream of your life. Yeah. And it's big and impressive and profound. You know, and in many respects, you know, the issue, the clinical challenge is not, you know, there are a set of clinical challenges, but it's, you know, it's not so much about how we can get more intense psychotherapeutic material during the trip sessions.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you are wading into the proverbial waterfall of, you know, psychotherapeutic material. It is overwhelming. Yeah. A lot of people will say this is like 15 years of psychotherapy in an afternoon. You know, the challenge is that you wade into that waterfall with little thimbles in your hands, and that's all you know, that's what you have to take the material out into the rest of your life. And so it's about, you know, turning those thimbles into buckets and closing the holes on those buckets so that you can carry more of that into the rest of your life. But you know, the idea that this is all placebo is, you know, it becomes absurd when you look at, you know, the patient reports and how dense they are with psychotherapeutic material that actually has direct relationship to the changes that people make in their lives and to the issues that they had prior.
I think I love that. And I love a good metaphor. Thanks, by the way. I love the waterfall. I love the thimble. I love the bucket. It's firmly planted in my mind. You're an excellent storyteller, despite being a geek.
Thanks.
We love a good geek, though. Most people, I was going to say everybody, but most people to some level have a pre-existing notion, idea or story about psychedelics and more broadly just drugs, you know, and I'm not talking about prescription drugs, but drugs, although these down the track will hopefully be prescribed in a clinical fashion, but you know, is part of the challenge and problem is that you're working against a lot of beyond just the research stuff and the clinical stuff that you're doing, but in terms of culture and mindset and collective kind of thought, is that there's a fair bit of pushback from people who don't want this to be, that can't be right. We can't be bloody prescribing this stuff. We can't be, you know, I'm thinking about a lot of people right now that, even to get them, I'm thinking, who can I get to listen to this conversation? Because that would definitely not work with, that would not fit in with their worldview. Mm. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is because I knew that it would be an intellectual conversation about something that people don't necessarily often intellectualize.
Right. Yeah. What you're talking about, Craig, is certainly relevant to my work. It's not remotely my main focus. I don't consider myself an advocate or involved in cultural change deliberately. I'm really focused on the science and the clinical applications and questions about consciousness and philosophy. But absolutely, you know, these socio-political views about drugs are relevant to the ability for me to do my work. And I definitely have encountered, you know, often these circular arguments like that might go something like this, like, aren't psychedelics dangerous? And I say, well, not necessarily. And they say, but they're illegal. And I say, well, why are they illegal? Well, because they're dangerous. And so there's this kind of roundabout that often happens. And I think people lose sight of a much better way to distinguish drugs. Or to classify drugs than whether they're on one or another side of the law, which is to do with the way drugs are used. As clearly we see that, you know, the way drugs are used matters a lot. The dose makes the poison, as well as, a whole set of contextual factors around drug use and who's using them. We see this, you know, with massive misuse of prescription drugs in the opioid crisis. These are legal drugs causing massive, societal destruction. And then you see, you know, substantial clinical benefit and personal development in, you know, self-medicated or ceremonial use of these illegal substances called psychedelics. So I think the way to think about it is in terms of how they're used. And there are certainly, you know, good and bad ways to use psychedelics.
Yeah.
You know, I really don't want to misrepresent them as being a walk in the park or something that, you know, was just maligned for political reasons and should, you know, be made available en masse and everybody should be encouraged to use them. They come with a set of risks that are, the classical psychedelics at least, are all within the psychological domain. They're physiologically incredibly safe.
Yes.
They're among the most, you know, something like LSD is among the most physiologically inert substance you can consume. And there are a few physiological concerns that one ought to have. So if you've got, say, major cardiac abnormalities or disease, then you ought to be concerned about consuming LSD because it can elevate blood pressure and heart rate. But so can coffee. At a high enough dose. So, um, But the risks are there, and they are psychological. And with the wrong kind of setup, or the wrong kind of dose, or the wrong kind of person, then you can definitely find yourself in trouble psychologically, with the potential for, at the extreme end, for real trauma.
Yeah. Most of my friends who have kind of opened the door on psychedelics, a friend, you need to be careful, don't you? Come on, Harps, think, all right, so I don't want to throw anyone under the bus, but so a friend of mine did, I won't even say what country this friend is in, but an ayahuasca journey, is that what they call it? Journey, where sure. they went away for 3 days and had this, ceremony and with, you know, and I know there are better and worse experiences of this, but for this person, they said to me, it was like, as you said before, Paul, I was living in a dream state and I stepped into the real world for the first time. And this person has a few, you know, nothing major, but a few, has never really felt like they fit in. And despite being, middle-aged, you know, not like 45-ish, and for the first time felt it, he said to me, it was like I had come home. And it's like, this has changed. And now, again, like you, therefore we should all do that. No, not saying that, not recommending, not anything, just reporting on a conversation I had with somebody that I trust and know very well. Like this idea that, and with some other experiences that he's told me about where, and this is only a very recent thing for him, and all very, very calculated and planned and methodical, and but where he would come back feeling like he's been somewhere for 2 months, all of these insights. And it's like, is it like for some people opening a spiritual portal, whatever that means, going into some other dimension that doesn't, in inverted commas, make sense?
Yeah, some people certainly talk about it or experience it in that way. You know, these are altered states of consciousness. And so by definition, they are unrecognizable, or at least some fundamental element of your awareness is altered. And that's very difficult to describe or even remember or simulate. A lot of people, you know, there are aspects of psychedelic experience that people will often attribute to something spiritual. Right. I'm quite interested in this, for example, because, that's not the story or the way I think about it. And I don't think it, I think what often will happen is that you'll have somebody who's got a particular worldview, a particular, say, metaphysics even, you know, they might be an atheist or a naturalist or an agnostic or whatever. And then they have an experience that they can't explain in the usual way. There's only kind of one alternative in their minds, which is to become, religious or to take on some other story. It's like, okay, well, the atheists can't explain this one, so the Christians can, or whatever it is, whatever the flavor is. So, I think there's something interesting here in basically doing a bit of psychoeducation around anomalous experience and the ways in which we could think about it or incorporate it or take it on in our lives. So I'll give you an example. There's this element of, this is one of these fascinating things. Most drug trips, are the experiences in the drug trip are considered just that, a drug-induced trip. You know, they don't inform the world or your life or tell you anything about reality. Mostly it's relegated in some way after the fact, no matter how, important you thought it was at the time, after the fact, well, that was just a drug-induced distortion of some form. So what's interesting with psychedelics, and I think key to their clinical efficacy, is that this doesn't happen, that there is a sense in which There's reliability in its representation. So it's showing you something that's true about your life or the world. And then strangely, that reliability seems to endure over time. Mm. I also think, and I do this a lot, when I think about the benefits of psychedelics, I tend to, these days, flip it on its head and think about the potential risks or costs that are associated with that. So what happens if we've got a situation where psychedelic experiences or aspects of them are tagged as being reliable representations and that have this enduring authority over time? What happens if you get that wrong?
Yeah.
You know, what happens if you feel in the psychedelic experience that, you get some message that, you're the chosen one, or there's something, or you got to divorce your wife, or you got to not divorce your wife, or whatever it is. And now, and it's tagged as highly reliable and it's got this authority. What happens when that goes awry? And I think it can go awry. Yeah. So, my sense is that one of the risks here is around the propensity to think either in naturalistic terms or in kind of, spiritualist terms, one or the other. And that I think there are actually multiple options and ways in which you can actually combine, a rational perspective on reality with, these kinds of, so-called anomalous experiences that seem to not be explained in the typical rational view. You can have a mystery under things. I mean, if you think about the scientific endeavor, fundamentally, we got this enormous enterprise of science, which is clearly, on track in so many ways. We wouldn't have technology if it weren't on track. We're asking nature some questions and listening to the answer that comes out of nature. That's called empiricism. And we're getting it right in many respects. That's why we can go to the moon and build iPhones. So it doesn't mean that that's the entire story of reality, but it's certainly on the money in many respects. And underneath this entire enterprise of science are fundamental mysteries. Like, where does it all come from? And, what started everything? And what's on the other side of infinity? And so I think we can continue to operate with mysteries without falling too quickly into what appear from my perspective to be, quite kind of materialistic views that get dressed up as New Age spiritualism. But, a lot of New Age spiritualism is quite materialistic in my view. It's an alternative to the scientific explanations of the physical world.
I'm not sure that God's going to be very happy with your answer, but okay. I think it's, do you think that sometimes stuff that is to the person in the middle of the experience, something that is inexplicable with their level of understanding or whatever, which is, same things happen to me with different whatever, but where we go, that makes absolutely no sense. That's not logical. It's inexplicable. That can't be scientifically explained, which means doesn't mean that's actually true. And then we go, therefore that is spiritual. Therefore that is. So if we can't, and the thing is that, because the human experience is subjective, we are constantly looking through our window of understanding and insight and awareness anyway, and making judgments based on our very limited operating system and understanding and trying to quantify and explain things that really for the most of us are inexplicable. Mm. Doesn't mean that therefore it's spiritual.
Mm. Yeah, no, absolutely. I agree. I think there's a whole lot more nuance that can be brought to this rather than kind of, falling into the buckets that are already prescribed and created for us. Mm. And there also are some risks associated, like, my concern with a lot of, the flip side, I should say, to these profound revelations, if you like, that get tagged with, reliability, which I think, are worth respecting and they can be very functionally important. People can have dramatic alterations in their views of their lives or their relationships or their self-identity that, have an impact on their lives, and it can be positive and important. Yeah. But I also feel like you know, it's worth holding a lot of these experiences, or the, I should say, the interpretation of these experiences lightly, you know, and the more we move into kind of, you know, grand and metaphysical revelations, the more lightly I think we ought to hold it. The same goes for, you know, one of the things I think about is the difficulty in the psychedelic experience in distinguishing between the literal and the metaphoric, or, you know, the visionary representation and, you know, the literal representation. So, you know, there are these reports, for example, of repressed memories that people have access to under psychedelics. I think, you know, it makes sense that some of that is true, but it also, you know, seems to be the case that some of those experiences that people think of as the emergence of repressed memories may just be incorrectly tagged. They may be simulations and you know, other kinds of visionary experiences that feel or appear to be repressed memories emerging, but they're not. And so that's got massive clinical implications. If you have an experience that is, say, you know, extremely challenging, and you think what you're experiencing is a real repressed memory from your childhood, you know, and then you take that on as a belief into the rest of your life, that can be detrimental to your mental well-being. It can be detrimental to your relationships. So I think there's something about holding lightly some of these interpretations, because we're now the psychedelic experience really is extraordinary, and I think taking a very literal and concrete and overly confident set of interpretations from it is potentially dangerous. Although part of that is also potentially useful, having a new perspective on your life that is helpful, that you can believe in, that you're confident in, is also useful. So it's complex to get it right.
Melissa and I had this interesting conversation a few weeks ago where she has this reoccurring thing in her life. Melissa, shut me up and correct me if I'm wrong, but she has these dreams that are so real, in inverted commas, that she wakes up and her body is still in that state of stress or heightened whatever.
Yeah.
And even though, you know, because the interesting thing is, obviously, when we're in a dream state, that we're, say, we're running away from a bloody, you know, a bad guy in the dream, and heart rate and blood pressure and cortisol and adrenaline, all of these things are happening, but we're actually safe and we're in bed, but our body doesn't know. So our body just responds, right? Sure. And I think that's when there's something going on in your brain that represents, and the representation in your brain is that something bad is happening. So there's this cascade of physiological consequences. And is that right, Melissa? Like sometimes halfway through the day, you can still feel uneasy because of the dream?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And even for me, memories of dreams 10, 15 years down the track, I still have certain images, and the longer time or goes on, the more I feel like those images are kind of filed in with real images of things that actually did happen. So the harder it becomes to tell the two apart, I guess.
And there's a physiological consequence, because if you are in danger or you think you're in danger, the response in the body is the same.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of overlap between psychedelic experience and dreams. And this is one example of it where, you know, you suspend disbelief and you're in a simulated world. But in many respects, you know, you can make that claim about normal conscious awareness as well. I mean, you know, the best explanations of how we generate consciousness really are, you know, stories about controlled hallucinations that we just all have in common with one another. Well, I mean, one of the key differences with psychedelics than dreams, however, is that dreams tend to be far more chaotic. And while there may be a whole lot of biographic material in there, or a whole lot of, there sometimes even are, you know, insights or stories that make sense or matter, it's often really jumbled and chaotic. And whereas with psychedelics, there's often, you know, if you set them up in the way that we do in the clinical context, with the right preconditions, there is often an unbelievably like surprising and almost unexpected structure to the psychedelic experience, that it's almost as if some part of you has orchestrated a grand visionary performance that you are actually an actor in, and it's got these, you know, incredibly pertinent, useful, central messages and takeouts and lessons for you. And they kind of, you know, they roll out of the performance as it goes, or maybe at the end of it all, people often will report what feels like an incredible wisdom or structure to the whole thing that is, in, you know, entirely bespoke. And then the quick inference after that, the kind of what I think of as maybe, you know, the lazy assumption is that somebody did that for you. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems all too well organized and so mm-hmm. perfect for you, and was the lesson you needed that you've been looking for 30 years, and delivered in a way that really lands in your body and your heart, and you can feel it. You know, you might have had some idea about this for years and years, but now you can feel it and you see something that changes your life. And so the quick inference is, oh, well, there looks to be some intention to this whole thing. It's too well orchestrated. Well, somebody's done that for me, which I think is an unnecessary inference to draw from the whole thing.
Well, I think God disagrees, Brother Paul. I'm just gagging. Hey, I think the difference is that, which you articulated beautifully, is that, you know, the dream that's quiet, there's more chaos, but with, it seems like, you know, psychedelic experiences, there's a level of clarity that doesn't happen in dreams, and a level of awareness or revelation, which is interesting. Now, I'm aware that you've got a meeting very soon, so we're going to start to wind up, but let's say with your research moving forward in the next 5-10 years, however long you're going to do that, let's say everything goes great, whatever that means for you. Everything goes great. You get green lit to do whatever you want. Boxes ticked, good results. There seems to be, you know, all positive stuff happening. What do you hope? Now, I know you can't put your, you know, because you're a scientist first and foremost, and it's about data, I get all of that, but you're still a human. What would you like to see happening if these trials prove, and this research proves, that, you know, there is a place in therapy for the use of psychedelics?
I suppose
that's the world's longest question, by the
way.
Yeah,
no, that's fine. Try to give a long pause to match it. Firstly, I'm an empiricist, so you know, I'll listen to the data. But also, you know, I'm doing this because I think there's a there. I don't know who it's going to work for and how to do it best. But I would love to see this treatment, or these sets of treatment approaches, further developed and refined for different indications and for different situations, and working better and better over time, and then, you know, rolled out in a ethical, sensible service delivery format, where, you know, which is not, you know, undermined by market forces or, you know, standard medical model or whatever, but rather that, you know, the context that supports it and affords it adapts to this rather unique treatment approach, which includes both a drug and a psychotherapy. It includes a dramatic altered state of consciousness for a, you know, a period of hours. It includes what look like transdiagnostic effects, so, you know, effects across a whole range of diagnostic boundaries, which, you know, basically, you know, sheds light, in my view, on the fallacy of the diagnostic boundaries in the first place. There are a whole set of unique elements to this, and also that bring about changes in people's lives that are not merely about the reduction in certain mental health symptoms. Yeah. Often people that come through these treatment cycles will say like, yeah, okay, my depression symptoms are massively reduced, but that's not the main game. Like actually these other things have changed in my life. Like I now have a relationship with, you know, my kids again, and I feel enthused about my writing project, and it's got an aspirational outcome as well. So, you know, there is a lot of movement at the station now. You know, it's a dynamic field and a dynamic time. You know, the Australian federal government just dropped $15 million in competitive grant funding for psychedelic clinical trials.
Wow.
It's the first time a government has done that for psychedelics. So that was only, about a month ago. And there are about 100 research trials active around the world right now. There is more philanthropic donation to a mental health treatment than has ever been seen before. About $200 million US dollars has been raised in crowdfunding and philanthropy in the psychedelic space.
Wow.
It's off the charts. So you know, it's a dynamic space, and yet it also is, you know, it's also complex, or I should say vulnerable to market forces, medical model, political
agendas,
players and agendas, egos. You know, this is fascinating kind of observation, I guess, that myself and many colleagues have, which is, you know, that in the context of something which is widely regarded as, you know, an induction method that can decimate your ego structures. I mean, this is one of the central things happening in a high dose psychedelic experience, that your sense of self identity becomes dismantled and shattered, and sometimes, you know, eradicated temporarily.
Yeah, dissolved.
Yeah. And in the context of this, you know, ego dissolving treatment approach, we have a ton of ego in the space that's been drawn to it. So perhaps that says something about the potential misuse. You know, there was this analogy drawn by somebody around, you know, misuse of antibiotics leading to virulent strains of the flu and bugs. And so, you know, misuse of an ego dissolving substance can produce virulent strains of ego. So there's a lot of action, and there's a lot of hope and excitement. And then, yeah, there's just all the usual dark side of the human situation coming into play very quickly. And in Australia, it's an interesting situation here, because we're standing on the shoulders of the giants overseas, who, you know, some of them were there in the first wave. You know, some of my colleagues overseas were delivering LSD in the 1960s in hospitals.
Wow. Wow.
And then, you know, some of them have been at it now in the second wave for maybe 25 years. And Australia is just arriving at the party. There have been a few of us that have been scholars of the field for, you know, a decade or more, but really a tiny handful. And there have been a few of us that have put our shoulders to the wheel trying to get the research back up in Australia over the last few years. And it's heartening to see that this is happening now. There are now, you know, 5 ethically approved psychedelic trials in Australia. And I'm happy to be on 4 of those, and there's another 2 coming at Monash, which are not yet ethically approved, but I'm setting up at Monash Uni, and a few others in the pipelines that are soon to be funded, and it's snowballing. But the interest in the space has just exploded, particularly in the last, say, 18 months or 2 years. And in the context of a kind of vacuum of precedent and power, and, you know, a lack of, say, a, you know, tribe of elders, if you like, that is the, you know, apparent in the places like the States in this space. You just have a lot of power grabbing going on and territory grabbing going on, which is interesting. You know, it's hopefully people who are interested in this space are interested in it genuinely, not just because they're low hanging fruit or it's the new hot stuff, but actually school up and get on that learning curve, because it's entirely unique. I think a lot of people who who are tuned into this are not aware, or are tuning in now, are not aware of how unique this treatment approach is, how much has already been done and is currently happening all over the world, and how much, you know, how big the giant is that we need, you know, whose shoulders we need to stand on. And, you know, I guess that's been a lot of my approach over the last couple of years, is apprenticing myself as best I can to the people at the coalface overseas, because they've really been doing this work for a long while now. So that's my, you know, my I have optimism, and I also just have a, you know, a strong encouragement to the community of medical and scientific people who want to get involved in this space. And, you know, $15 million from the federal government will also make a whole lot of people want to get involved in this space. It's just a strong encouragement to get on that learning curve, which is, you know, which is substantial, and get interested in what really matters in this unique treatment approach, because it's exciting and it's important for both the safety and the efficacy that we don't reinvent the wheels, or just apply, say, you know, standard psychiatric chemotherapeutic models to this, or make all kinds of assumptions that one could make when faced with something quite unusual. So that's, you know, that wasn't an answer to your question. That was a tangential ramble. But, you know, my hope is that we have a viable, healthy research and service delivery context in which, you know, the treatment approach is further developed. Our understanding of mental health is further developed. Our understanding of consciousness is further developed. And a ton of people who have inadequate treatment options now are actually receiving really effective, sustainable treatment through psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy, and do better on account of that.
Well, mate, we love a good tangential bloody ramble, and we love some good science, and we love a good conversation. Now, we know you've got a hard out in about 30 seconds. This is normally the part of the show where we tell people how to follow you and connect with you, but I'm guessing that you don't really do that too much, or do you? Can people connect with you or follow you? Do you have social media? What's the go with that?
Yeah, I am on Twitter. That's as far as I go on social media. You can find me at P. Lichnitsky. You could put it in the show notes, or, you know, somebody could look me up. You can also find me on the Monash website. Yes, and by all means, if somebody would like to, you know, learn more or be on a notification list as a prospective participant or a prospective therapist or a collaborator, by all means, you can email us psychedelic@monash.edu. And yeah, I'd love to hear from anybody who has an interest in this space. We're training therapists. We're starting new trials. Prospective funders are more than welcome to get in touch with me.
If you've got a lazy $5 million sitting around,
that's right.
I'll be the conduit between you and your money and Paul.
There'll
be a small fee, something negotiable.
Great.
Mate, we appreciate you being on the U Project. Thanks so much for your time. We know you've got an appointment right now, but look after you, and thanks for taking the time out.
Thanks, Craig. Really great to chat with you. Appreciate what you're doing, and thanks, Melissa. All the best.
Pleasure, man. Thanks, everybody. Love you guys. Bye-bye.